This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. It's now been 5 years since the beginning of the Flint water crisis. One of the first reporters working on that story was Kurt Guyette. He's the investigative reporter with the American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me in. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start at the beginning. What led you to even look at the Flint story?
I was hired by the ACLU of Michigan to specifically report on Michigan's emergency manager law. And Flint was under the control of an emergency manager. So when I started going up there and just getting a feel for things and how things were going under the emergency manager, the first thing that people were talking about was the water and both the quality of the water or the lack of quality of the water and also the exorbitant price of the water. And so one thing led to another. But I certainly didn't start out to investigate what was going on with Flint's water. It was more an outgrowth of what was happening under emergency management.
You know, it has been 5 years, so there are probably a lot of people who've heard of the Flint water crisis, but might not know exactly what that was all about. Can you give us a brief overview?
What happened was that under the control of the emergency manager, whose function was to balance the budget by whatever means necessary to make sure that bondholders were paid, unilaterally made the decision to use the Flint River as the city's water source while a new pipeline was being built. And what the emergency manager said at the time was that by using the river over the course of 2 years while that pipeline was being built, they would save $5 million. And so they stopped using the Detroit regional system that had been providing clean, safe water for about 50 years and switched to use the river. The problem was that they did not really know how to properly treat the river. They didn't even have all the equipment necessary to do the job at the Flint water treatment plant. And they knew this. At the time, the person managing the plant said, if you go ahead and start doing this, it's over my objections because we're not ready. And one of the things was that they didn't have the equipment necessary to apply mandatory corrosion control chemicals. And so what happened was they went from a low corrosion source, Huron River, that was being properly treated to a very highly corrosive source, the Flint River, which has a lot of salt, which makes it very corrosive. And then on top of that, did not use corrosion control chemicals that were required by law. And so that highly corrosive river water started running through pipes and almost just chewing things up.
And the big problem, of course, were lead pipes. There were some lead pipes,
yes.
usually at the end point, so people were getting lead in their water.
Yes, very, now, very high amounts of lead.
In your early reporting, you were actually knocking on doors and taking water samples. What gave you that idea?
Well, after building a relationship with some of the activists up there, one of them, Leanne Walters, had been given an internal EPA draft memo written by Miguel Del Toro, who looked at what was going on. They were already working with Mark Edwards at Virginia Tech at that point. In the course of that testing, one of the samples had lead levels of 11,300 parts per billion, which is almost 2.5 times what it takes for water to be classified as hazardous waste. It was the highest levels they had ever seen. So they were just off the charts. So Del Toro started looking into it. He's the one public official in this whole story that really showed that he cared and did what was required, which is to investigate and find out what was going on.
And he was with the US EPA.
He's a regional water specialist with the US EPA. And really, I think one of the really truly unsung heroes in all this because of what he did. He went to the Walters home, established that there was no lead plumbing in their house, so determined right off the bat that it had to be coming from outside the home. And then he found out that they were not using corrosion control. And so he just put everything together and said, this isn't an isolated problem. If you look at the science, then there's a very high probability that the lead levels are going to be very dangerous throughout the city based on this. We reported that memo. The Michigan Department of Environmental Quality wouldn't take my calls, answer my questions. So we ran with the story, posted it on our website. And then you guys, thankfully, followed up on it. Michigan Radio then picked up the ball and ran with it.
So the Flint paper did, to be fair, the Flint paper did a lot of work at the beginning too, right?
It was really first the ACLU and then Michigan Radio that really got it going. Others followed up, But Michigan Radio contacted MDEQ, Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. They did respond to you guys and said, we've been testing water all over Flint. Nothing to see here. When it comes to lead in the water, the people of Flint can just relax. So then at that point, it was a he said, she said story. They're classifying Del Toro of the EPA as a rogue employee, that he didn't go through the proper channels with his memo, and that basically you can't trust him. He's a rogue employee. So how do you get to the truth? And that's when we came up with the idea of, what about if we can do our own tests? And so I called Mark Edwards, said, what do you think? And he said, yeah, we could do it. Then he applied for a emergency grant from the National Science Foundation, which came up with $50,000 to send 300 sample kits to Flint. And I was working with residents there on the ground, and we began going out and really did something that was unprecedented. The scope of the citizen-led testing, nothing like that had ever been done before. Edwards sent 300 samples. We distributed them and collected, like, I think 270 of them back, which just blew Edwards away. It was so far beyond expectations. And then those tests were used to essentially prove that the lead levels were much higher than what the city and state was testing. At the same time that was going on, I was filing FOIAs. Edwards began filing FOIAs to uncover that, because how do you explain the Virginia Tech tests are showing levels high up here, the city and state are showing low down here? How do you account for that discrepancy? And the answer was, well, they were cheating on their tests and using those doctored results to give the residents false assurances that their water was safe.
You filed a lot of Freedom of Information Act requests with state agencies, and you found that people in government were pretty flip about what was happening, in denial. Why don't you think they took the situation more seriously?
I think it all goes back to the emergency manager law. Without the emergency manager law, you have sort of a system of checks and balances in place. The city of Flint has its role, and then the MDEQ has its role to provide oversight. That was gone. It was all the same team. It was the emergency manager appointed by the governor that made this disastrous decision to switch to the river. The state agency that he appoints the director of sees that they are getting these high results. At one point, they send an email saying, boy, the tests you have been doing are coming in high. You better hope that none of the remainder of the tests come in over the action level, or else you're going to be out of compliance. So they were covering for each other because they were all part of the same team. So I don't think it was flipness, as it was they were trying to cover over the fact that this decision made by the emergency manager to use the river water was a disaster. And I don't know this for certain, but I think they were hoping that we could just get past it. You know, the pipeline's going to get built. In 2 years, we'll be back on cleaner, safer water, and this will all be in the rearview mirror. I think that they were just hoping to ride it out, despite the fact that doing so was, you know, leading to the lead poisoning of a city's water supply.
So given that, how do you restore faith in a government agency, or agencies in this case, after the kind of behavior that happened with Flint?
It's tough, but it doesn't help restore faith when the law that even the governor's own task force acknowledges was a direct cause. And I don't even like using the word crisis. I think the better word is disaster. Crisis, it gives the idea that it's something, you know, short-lived and contained. This was a—
I've been calling it the Flint water debacle most of the time.
But it really, crisis is not the right word. But this was a totally avoidable man-made disaster. So the law that everyone acknowledges was a pivotal factor in this disaster, nothing has been done to change it. You know, I equate it to, if you're NASA and you shoot off 8 rockets and one of them blows up on the launch pad, you don't say, well, look at how great these other 7 performed. You look at what caused that to blow up, and then you make sure that never happens again. Now, the problem with that analogy is that's not to say that there were not problems associated with the other 7 cities that were taken over by the emergency manager law. And it's not extreme, because people died as a result of this. You know, there's at least 11 Legionnaires' disease deaths. One study estimated that there might have been almost as many as 200 miscarriages as a result of this. Back to the Legionnaires, it's almost certainly much higher, because the state did not issue an alarm saying there's a Legionnaires outbreak, again, because they saw it being connected to the switch to the river and covered it up, that physicians did not know. If someone came to them with pneumonia-like symptoms, they thought it was pneumonia rather than thinking it's Legionnaires because the alarm had not been sounded.
I recently spoke to the new director of the newly named Department of Environmental Great Lakes and Energy, what was the DEQ, Liesl Clark, and I asked her about how do you change a culture of an agency when you know people behave the way they did regarding Flint. Do you think a new administration is enough to make a difference in a state government agency?
Well, it depends on how they act. So along with making a concerted effort to change or repeal the law that caused this, you know, there's also the issue of there's these class action and individual civil suits filed on behalf of the people of Flint to give them some compensation for all the damage that has been done to them. The state using taxpayer money to pay for attorneys for all the individuals named as defendants in those civil suits continue to fight this. I think the first class action lawsuit was filed in November of 2015. So almost 3.5 years after that, the state is still fighting against providing compensation to the people who the state's actions caused. Now, up until the last election, the people calling the shots were the people that were being named as defendants in these lawsuits. So now there's a different situation with the new governor, the new attorney general. They come in with kind of a clean slate. They don't have the baggage that the previous administration had. And so they are in a position to do the right thing and finally settle this suit. So in terms of restoring faith, it's up to them to show that they are really, truly looking out for the best interests of Flint, and settling that lawsuit would be one way to do that.
You talked about the emergency manager law, but the price of water was also a key issue that led to all of Flint's problems. And the price of water is a real issue in several places around the state. Part of it's white flight from cities, leaving a huge infrastructure behind with a lot fewer people to pay for it. What do you think Michigan should be doing about the high price of water in places like Flint and Detroit?
Well, and I don't think it's just the state. I think since the 1970s, the federal government's funding of water infrastructure programs has been reduced by about like 75%. And it's those infrastructure costs that are playing a big role in driving up the price. I mean, you have these old water mains that need to be repaired and replaced. Doing so is very expensive. And as it is now, a place like Flint, used to be 200,000 people, now it's fewer than 100,000 people. It was the home of General Motors, now has been to a large extent abandoned. There's still some production going on there, but not like what it was. So the tax base has been decimated, but you still have the same costs, which are being more and more and more placed on the backs of residents, which, you know, Flint, I think the poverty rate is probably around 40% there. And so you have lots of poor people that really cannot afford to pay for all these upgrades that are needed. And so the funding is going to have to come from elsewhere because the money just isn't there to pay it without, you know, continuing to price more and more people out of being able to pay for water.
Let's step back 5 years later, right? What are the lessons that we should have learned from Flint?
Well, one is that it's a bad idea to take away democracy from people. I keep going back to that, but that was my mission, was to, you know, report on the emergency manager law.
Yeah.
And that I think it's generally acknowledged the Flint City Council would not have made the decision to use the river water. That was a decision that was imposed on them. In fact, it was March of 15, the Flint City Council voted to return to the Detroit system, and the emergency manager said no, that you can't afford it. What's the next question? And besides, the water's just fine, so shut up and keep drinking it, was their attitude. So I think the number one lesson from my perspective is it is a bad idea to take away people's democracy. And also it gets to the issue of austerity economics, that the most important thing is to make sure you have a balanced budget. Well, you know, Governor Snyder came in with the mantra, we're going to run government like a business. Well, government's not a business. It's not all about the bottom line. The primary function of government is to ensure the safety and well-being of the people it's there to serve. And it's not a business. And you cannot just have your eye strictly on the bottom line, because when you do, then disasters like Flint happen.
You know, eventually national media were all over this story. I wonder what the lessons to be learned are for the media, the news media.
Boy, it's tough, I think, because news media are increasingly being stretched thinner and thinner and thinner. When I was hired and we got a grant from the Ford Foundation to pay for my position, one of the points that was made in obtaining that grant was that investigative reporting is critical to a well-functioning democracy. It's part and parcel of that. But mainstream media, because of the financial constraints that are increasingly being placed on it, are cutting back on investigative reporting because it's so expensive to do. But certainly, it attests to the fact for the essential need of good, thorough investigative reporting to not take on face value what you're being told. Oh, the water's safe, the water's safe, the water's safe. Well, geez, lots of people are saying they're sick, you know, their hair's falling out in clumps, they're breaking out in rashes. It doesn't smell good, it doesn't look good. I don't know really how you can say it's safe, but, you know, filing all those FOIAs, taking the time to really be able to dig into an issue and uncover the truth about what's going on, it's difficult and it's costly, but it's absolutely essential.
I got to ask you, because you work for the ACLU, it has a lot of lawyers, not so many journalists, right? And that led to questions about whether you were a reporter or an advocate. How do you address that?
Well, I think that's legitimate. And, you know, we submitted our work to the Pulitzer Committee and they rejected it because it was done for an advocacy organization. On the other hand, I got Michigan Journalist of the Year from the Michigan Press Association. To me, it's not as important whether people consider me a journalist or not. You know, with the MDEQ, there's this email, oh, this journalist from the ACLU, and they put the word journalist in quotation marks because they obviously did not consider me a real journalist. Whether people consider me a journalist or not didn't really matter. What mattered to me was, am I doing what a good journalist does, which is to make sure that your facts are right, to give everybody a chance to respond to it. You know, that's what's important, the work itself, not whether people consider me a journalist or not.
What are you working on these days?
I've been working on bail reform. I've been collecting stories of people who have been harmed by the current bail system as part of a bigger effort to reform Michigan's cash bail system. Certain things need to be done that aren't happening now that are resulting in people being put in jail while they await trial, much to the detriment of them and also to taxpayers because a lot of money is being wasted.
Now you got a reading assignment, folks. That's what you need to look for. Kurt Guyette was the first to begin reporting on the Flint water crisis, a government-caused crisis that we're still paying for in many different ways besides money. Thanks for your good work. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Still to come, the push for a sandhill crane hunt and a cocktail to send you into the weekend. You're listening on Stateside. Stay with us.